Today on Against the Grain, what does the far right learn from the Frankfurt School? And in turn, what can we learn from Frankfurt School thinkers like Theodore Adorno and Herbert Marcuse to understand the appeal of the right?
This is what Trump calls the weave. The weave is basically, it's just a free association of ideas. It's easy for the listener to follow because there's no thinking to be done. And you just give yourself up to the stream of words. So the other thing with fascist propaganda, it's very oral. And you give yourself up to the stream of words. And that's why you can go from immigrants to Shark Week, to wind farms, to battleships, to ballrooms, to crypto. It doesn't matter. It's just the weave. And therefore, it's like, you don't need to think. You're there for the show.
Scholar Paul Fleming sheds light on the fixation of conservatives like Christopher Rufo, who set about remaking higher education with cultural Marxism. He also discusses Adorno's insights into the attraction of authoritarian leaders. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The American far right has a strange fascination with the Frankfurt School. On the one hand, they bizarrely attribute all that's wrong in American society to the influence of the Marxist thinkers who fled Germany during fascism. And on the other, they believe that they have much to learn from the Frankfurt School's focus on culture as an arena of political struggle. To make sense of it all, I'm joined by Paul Fleming. He teaches German and comparative literature at Cornell University and co-edits New German Critique. Paul, before I ask you how the right, in equal measure, both demonizes the Frankfurt School and appropriates from it, can you remind our listeners what the Frankfurt School was and, in broad brushstrokes, what their signal contributions were?
The Frankfurt School is an eclectic but nonetheless unified group of scholars and theorists who specialize in all the various fields of the humanities and social sciences, from musicology to sociology to philosophy to literary criticism to psychology to economics, you name it. It's part of the mix of the Frankfurt School. The main figures, the ones that are most well known, are certainly Theodore Adorno, who, like almost all of them, was in exile in the United States during the war, forced out as a Jewish intellectual to the United States. Max Horkheimer is the one who, one of the leaders of the Frankfurt School. He also was in exile in the United States. Herbert Marcuse is another major figure. Though he's very important to the United States, is not read as much today, and that's something also to think about. And then certainly Walter Benjamin, a little bit peripheral, but is probably the biggest name, together with Adorno, affiliated with the Frankfurt School. I mean, the main thing that separates the Frankfurt School, kind of gives them their signature, is a deep fidelity to Marxism and the critique of political economy, but saying that political economy is not enough. You need other things, most of all, psychoanalysis or some version of psychology. In other words, the economy will not explain everything. And then a big emphasis on culture, on the so-called superstructure, and particularly in the 20th century when mass culture takes off. This is not just then an expression of the superstructure, but is an economic force in itself and a force of ideology in itself. And therefore, culture together with psychology as major supplements to an economic analysis, a Marxist economic analysis, are kind of three key features, I would say, at the Frankfurt School.
How long and really from what origins has the U.S. right had a fixation on the Frankfurt School and its critical theory and its supposed widespread influence on U.S. society in the form of cultural Marxism?
It goes back to the 60s, and there's multiple phases of this that begins with figures such as Lyndon LaRouche and people around him. And certainly it includes people in the Buchanan camp. It goes back quite a way, but it really took off again around 2000 with a notion of political correctness, and somehow the Frankfurt School being basically responsible for a notion of political correctness, so that they draw a straight line from the civil rights movement to affirmative action, to so-called political correctness, to so-called DEI and wokeness. That's kind of the trajectory, and that the Frankfurt School is considered responsible for this rot within American society. It really takes up steam in the part that I find more interesting with Andrew Breitbart in 2011 with Righteous Indignation, that has a whole chapter on them. And written in a somewhat funny way, it is picked up when Trump first became president in 2017. There was a NSC memo called POTUS and Political Warfare that quotes Marcuse's Repressive Tolerance chapter and verse three times. In the 1776 Commission report, Marcuse there is called out by name as the intellectual godfather of American identity politics, and quote that his ideas led to the development of critical race theory. In other words, it's really taken off in the last few years. And then for me, the crowning moment is Christopher Rufo's America's Cultural Revolution, How the Radical Left Conquered Everything. So it's been going on for a while. It's gone through various phases. But at this point, in the last 20, 25 years, it's really centered around notions of identity politics, political correctness, woke DEI, whatever you want to call that. That's what the real focus is as far as the obsession with them.
Would it be fair to say that what the right calls and obsesses about as Frankfurt School cultural Marxism is really more directed at liberalism in U.S. society rather than on the radical left?
That's exactly it. I mean, that's the kind of the somewhat hilarious moment around this. I mean, there's actually reading these things with the proper critical distance is actually quite funny reading them. But what they're really after has nothing to do with the radical left. It's all about kind of good mainstream liberal society in its focus on gender and race, these kind of crucial two elements. I mean, the interesting thing, when you read Breitbart, when you read Rufo, what falls out is Marx. It has nothing to do with economics. It has nothing to do with class. And so you get this kind of, it's not even a truncated, it's just a perverted version of Frankfurt School where they stand in for something. That's kind of the interesting thing is, why do they need to stand in for that thing? But they stand in for that thing that they feel has now just corrupted American society.
Well, you mentioned Christopher Rufo, and I wonder if you could tell listeners who he is and what impact he's had on U.S. politics, especially the politics of education.
So Rufo is really kind of a burst onto the scene in the last few years. He's a scholar at the Manhattan Institute and other places, but he's the one who weaponized the notion of critical race theory. That was largely his invention. He's the one who got it out there and just turned it into this call to arms against higher education. He's the one who, with Ron DeSantis in Florida, overturned the great, you know, public liberal arts school, the New College, and turned it into a conservative version of that. He's the one who basically helped unearth the so-called plagiarism, the plagiarism of Claudine Gay, and therefore was helped behind the toppling of the three Ivy League presidents in that year.
Right. This is the president of Harvard in the middle of the so-called anti-Semitism scandal at Harvard.
Exactly. And so he's been, in the last 2 to 3 years, probably the most influential voice in higher education in the Trump era. This was his call was to get at the university as the kind of the core of the problem and to take it on to the point where he says the goal is to inflict existential terror on the university. And the way you do that is the way Trump has, the mechanism of federal funding.
Before we get to Marcuse, I just want to ask you about that whole orientation of the right, because, you know, we can see the right as kind of bonkers, right, with this fixation on cultural Marxism. It's so out there. And in a sense, it's not totally weird that it sort of entered into the world ages ago through Lyndon LaRouche, who was this, you know, nutty figure who was on the left and then kind of went on to the fascist right. And the idea of the Frankfurt School's cultural Marxism being something that amazingly is ubiquitous in society and we just don't know it, it seems really kind of crazy. On the other hand, doesn't the focus of the MAGA right on culture, on universities, on the humanities, which, you know, as you have noted in some of your writings, you know, a decade or two ago was seen as this kind of worthless realm of scholarship, you'll never get a job. And now the humanities are the source of everything terrible in the world. isn't the far right actually getting to something genuinely powerful, which is the realm of culture and education?
I totally agree. So, I mean, this is where things get interesting for me and where we need to take Rufo and others very seriously. And the reason why I'm interested in the Rufo book is I'm one of the ones who thinks that Marcuse should be read more, that hasn't been received as much in favor of Adorno and Benjamin, which are industries in themselves. I mean, they're self-perpetuating machineries of publication. Marcuse has been dropped a bit. And it's funny that Marcuse, of all people, would now be the one that's the punching bag. But you're absolutely right about the importance of culture. And the other one I want to throw in there is critique. So when Rufo writes his book, it's 70 pages on Marcuse, 70 pages on Angela Davis, 70 pages on Paulo Freire, and 70 pages on Derrick Bell. And he aligns them as critical theory, critical praxis, critical pedagogy, and critical race theory. The common element there is critique. I mean, one of the things that they're really worried about is critique and a notion of a critical relationship to society. I put that in the first thing. And the second, as you mentioned, is culture. And this is where the reason why I find Breitbart kind of the beginning of what makes this interesting and why we really need to engage the MAGA right in its obsession with culture and particularly then the Frankfurt School is that Breitbart's the one who has attributed at least that famous line, politics is downstream from culture. And I think this would also be a Frankfurt School insight. And Breitbart even goes on to say, this is a quote from him, we can't win the political war until we win the cultural war. Breitbart says it's the Frankfurt School knew that. That's why they won the cultural war. And then on its back, the political war. Leave out the part about the political war. But his point of like the Frankfurt School knew the importance of culture. This is why I think they're at the center of this obsession, because they realize culture is important. That, you know, the culture is a huge sphere, not just as an economic sphere, but an ideological sphere. And that's why I think Rufo and others needs Marcuse and the Frankfurt School, because they need the importance of culture. And this is why the university then becomes the heart of the problem. Typically, you know, there's been a relationship between, you know, art and aesthetics since Kant. But with the Frankfurt School, it's the first group to really put mass culture, popular culture, going back to Krakow in the 1920s, at the center of their reflections, including Adorno's famous and Horkheimer's famous notion of the culture industry. In other words, it's a Marxism that also focuses on the superstructure and also sees the superstructure as its own form of the base. And therefore, culture then, it's a dual thing. On the one hand, it's mass culture as a commodity, but culture is also spaces, any space of independent thought, universities, museums, media. And Adorno will repeat over and over, the first thing an authoritarian government goes after are spaces of independent thought.
Now, of course, Rufo succeeded with many of the things that you listed off earlier, actually before the second Trump administration. But obviously, Trump's second term now is transforming the universities. And one of the things that seems quite baffling is, you know, the destruction of the sciences within universities, which, you know, for certain parts of Trump's coalition, the tech side of things, it just seems rather counterproductive, to say the least. But do you think that this agenda is driven by the idea that if universities are a kind of center for critical thinking, critique, that it's worth kind of wrecking the whole thing to wreck that?
Oh, Rufo's explicit about that. And his answer is yes. I mean, you know, the whole point is to bring the university to heel and by any means necessary. And, you know, and therefore it's, I mean, again, as you mentioned earlier, what's interesting, the humanities used to be kind of the joke, because when in the old days of conservatism, when it was just an economic neoliberal agenda, not that it isn't that still, but it was that the humanities were looked down upon because they were seen as somewhat useless. They didn't have any job value. That's not true as well, but nonetheless, that was the agenda. Now with Rufo, with the others, actually, humanities are the core of the problem. In other words, humanities are taken incredibly seriously because they realize how powerful the humanities are. And therefore, ironically, they're willing to go after the university and the, you know, including the sciences in order to bring the humanities to heel, to move it away from a certain notion of culture and certainly a notion of critique. And therefore, yeah, I mean, I think it's really at the center of the debates, because this is where they see the front line. This is the front line in the battle. It begins with the university. He's explicit about this. For Ruffo, it begins with the university, and then it moves to the media, and then it moves to the federal government, and then moves to corporation. And for him, this is on the past tense. It's already taken over. The radical left has already won everything. The lines that he has about somehow that you know, lines like, today America is living inside Marcuse's revolution, or Marcuse's dream of liberating tolerance has been achieved. These kind of like dispatches from the front lines of the war, I find somewhat hilarious. And to say, like, the one problem with his book is that, you know, that the radical left has taken over everything. It's just that the problem is the radical left's taken over nothing. And that you can see that when he gets to the corporations, because he has to address critical theory and Marxism there. And he says, we have to recognize that critical theorists were vicious critics of capitalism. And then he says, companies as Walmart condemn objectivity, individualism, power hoarding as white supremacy culture, while ruthlessly operating on those principles in the global market. And this is him. The result, of course, is critical theory as farce. The ideology of the revolution passed through the Human Resources Department. And that's where you could say, like, exactly, you finally figured it out. But that's Marcuse. You know, that's not a criticism of Marcuse. That is Marcuse. That's the one-dimensional society. Then he finally gets to, like, oh, corporations are no longer about maximizing profits. They actually just are there to manage diversity and inclusion, which would be news to me, to the CEOs, to the shareholders, to Wall Street. You know, you name it. And so there's just the preposterous, you have to begin the discussion of Ruffo with just how preposterous the thesis is, like just how bonkers it is. And once you always have to keep that in mind, then you can start analyzing things. But I don't want to leave out just like how ridiculous it is. The radical left has conquered nothing. All he means with radical left is DEI and woke, and that got a tiny foothold in certain institutions in the last few years. The other thing is just, of course, that like for Ruffo, the real cause of all this is George Floyd, but not the fact that a police officer, kneeled on a man's back for almost 10 minutes and suffocated him to death. That part's, for him, it's fine. It's the riots after that are like the real scandal around this. And that's, for him, is like the real instigator of the real crisis we're in, is George Floyd, not as the victim of police brutality and the systemic brutalization of black bodies from slavery through the police force today, but actually those riots after that he thinks are just the downfall of America.
To what degree do you think that a figure like Ruffo genuinely believes that the ideas of the Frankfurt School have transformed America, have remade America into the image of the radical left? And how much of that is hyperbole to justify an agenda?
I actually think he believes it. And I think we have to assume that most of them truly believe it. But I would say the hyperbole is an important, crucial tactic. You have to say the radical left conquered everything. And you have to put it in terms of Mao's cultural revolution, but now as America's cultural revolution, in order to justify. And this is kind of the authoritarian tactic or device that, as Adorno would call it. The hyperbole is a justification for the brutal and absolutely devastating backlash. No, so he needs to put it in that register of this is a complete takeover of everything we know and love about the good old USA in order to justify what he calls it a muted, tamed response to the Trump administration's around higher education. He actually thinks they could be and should be much more radical than they have been. And so you need the hyperbole as a justification for the resulting brutality.
I'm speaking with Paul Fleming, professor of comparative literature and German studies at Cornell. He co-edits the journal New German Critique. We're discussing what the far right draws from the Frankfurt School as well as their demonization of it. And Paul, you mentioned that Christopher Ruffo, this highly influential conservative activist, lays at the feet of Herbert Marcuse, the critical theorist of the Frankfurt School, all that is terrible and woke in the world. I wonder if you could say a few words about Marcuse, who, as you note, is really one of the most forgotten members of the Frankfurt School, and how he ended up being such a significant influence in the New Left in the U.S.
I mean, so Marcuse is, like Adorno, like Horkheimer, a German Jewish intellectual. Marcuse, however, started out a bit differently. He initially worked with Martin Heidegger, kind of one of the great enemies of the Frankfurt School. And so therefore, he was a little bit on the outside. When the Nazis came to power, he could no longer work with Heidegger. And that's when he first became aligned with the Frankfurt School. He was initially quite close to Horkheimer. There was a little bit of a rivalry between he and Adorno. This is one of the things that plays out behind the scenes. When Horkheimer wrote his famous essay, Traditional and Critical Theory, it was Marcuse who wrote kind of not the response, but the addendum to that, and not Adorno. And when they first got to the U.S., it was a consideration as to whether it should be Horkheimer and Marcuse writing some version of Dialect of Enlightenment together, or Adorno. Ultimately, Adorno then became the close confidant of Horkheimer, and Marcuse was a little bit on the out. So therefore, Marcuse, he worked for a long time for the U.S. government. I mean, he worked for the precursor to the CIA, and for many years was in Washington together with Kirchheimer and Neumann, kind of the three that formed the other Frankfurt School, working for the government to talk about denazification and then about the Soviet Union. So he knows the U.S. government and the workings of it inside and out. He only became a professor quite late. I believe he was already in the 60s when he got the job at Brandeis, and moved to UC San Diego when I believe he was already 65, already at retirement age. But it's there, you know, that he at Brandeis is where he met the young undergraduate student Angela Davis, and that developed that long relationship of kind of mutual mentor and teacher to each other between them. I mean, the thing is, Adorno and Horkheimer returned to Germany after the war, I believe 1949, early 50s, they're already back in Germany. Marcuse stays. And that's a crucial, crucial difference because their experience of the post-war world is very different. With Adorno, Horkheimer, it's returning to Germany in the shadow of the Shoah and fascism and basically an unstable, still not yet settled democratic West Germany. Marcuse stays in the United States, and there it's civil rights movement. It's the anti-Vietnam movement. It's the anti-imperialism movement. It's women's rights movements. And therefore, he has a very different view on things. It also begins, he gets to be involved with student activists. And I think that's where he becomes the so-called godfather of the new left. But by the late 60s, with One Dimensional Man, 1964, he suddenly takes off and becomes, that's a book that sold over the course of its publication, I believe 1 million copies throughout the world. That's where he kind of takes on this kind of guiding role to students. I mean, he was by chance in May 68 in Paris and spoke there, was regularly in dialogue with students. And therefore, from the mid-60s to his death in 1979, he was a genuine public intellectual in the United States. I mean, he was kind of everywhere, ubiquitous, New York Times, PBS. He was there, and therefore quite a well-heard voice in the United States.
So in Christopher Rufo's book that you mentioned, published in 2023, America's Cultural Revolution, How the Radical Left Conquered Everything, one quarter of the book is on Marcuse, and one quarter is on his student, and you also say sort of collaborator, Angela Davis. What does Rufo draw from Marcuse? How does he trace Marcuse's influence from the heyday of the New Left to our world today?
I mean, so one thing that then separates Marcuse apart from the rest of the Frankfurt School, and that's why I find him interesting, but this is also what makes him the target of the MAGA right at this moment, is Marcuse, because he stayed in the United States, the Frankfurt School is really not great beyond what we now call the Global North and the issues surrounding the Global North and largely kind of white European and America working class and society in general. Marcuse is the first one to actually have an ear for race and gender and the so-called third world. And so one of the things that he picks up on that Adorno just never really has an ear for and is even quite resistant to, there's good work coming out this in the coming years, is race and gender and the global dimension of capitalism and therefore notions of imperialism and colonialism. And so the latter work of Marcuse, you know, Lecture on Liberation and the essays from the 1970s, he will emphasize race and gender to a degree that the other Frankfurt School scholars don't. And therefore, this emphasis on civil rights, on black power, on what he calls the non-integrated. So he's looking for, since the working class you know, history showed that the working class would not by necessity align with an anti-capitalist force, that it could align with capitalism. You know, Adorno would call it, it would identify with existing society and try to slot itself in. He was looking, Marcuse was looking for forces, groups that he called the non-integrated. And this were Black, Chicanos, Latinx, it's queer people, it's women, and it's students. And he's the first to see that there's actually something shared in common that's not necessarily a class relationship, but the relationship of non-integration into existing society that would give them some potential common cause. And this element is then the thing picked up on by the MAGA right as the precursor to DEI, wokeness, whatever you want to call it. Of course, they can only do that by dropping, leaving the bottom out of Marxism and the fundamental kind of economic relationship that fuels that non-integration.
Why is Herbert Marcuse not remembered on the left, but apparently is remembered, you know, pretty well on the right, or at least sections of the right, like Christopher Rufo?
It's an excellent question, because, you know, the funny thing when they, you know, when you read the 1776 report and you read Rufo and you read even Breitbart, who's the first to put Marcuse, or one of the first to put Marcuse at the center of this. So I'm co-editor of New German Critique. New German Critique being one of the journals that kind of most aligned with the Frankfurt School that's been around since the early 70s. We've been around almost 55 years. And I can tell you, looking at the record, you know, after Marcuse's death in the 70s, where we published a few essays on him in the 70s, after that, in New German Critique, there is one essay on Herbert Marcuse every decade, in a journal dedicated to Frankfurt School critical theory, more or less. You know, we can do multiple special issues on Adorno and Benjamin a year. Marcuse's been forgotten. He gets picked up by the right because of his seeing that it's not just class and not just psychology, but race and gender play into this. And that element's what allows him to do it. And the other thing is his controversial essay from 1966, Repressive Tolerance, that is a little bit of a blunt instrument that has lines that can be easily quoted and used against him.
Given that, why should we on the left revisit him today? I mean, you've already made the case that what the far right is obsessed with, which is Marcuse's attention to race and class and other groups that might be marginalized by the capitalist liberal establishment, that those are virtues. Those are things to revisit ourselves. But beyond that, you write about how Marcuse saw theory and practice and how it differed from some of his comrades who came out of the Frankfurt School, like Adorno.
What sets Marcuse apart is, you know, after the war, there was a desire on Marcuse that they needed to refound the Institute for Social Research and refound it around the displaced and non-integrated forces, including, he says, immigrant farmers. You know, I mean, so he's very explicit about there's new dimensions that need to be brought into the theorization of Frankfurt School critical theory. And another crucial element is that Marcuse, unlike Adorno, and there's that famous letter exchange between them from 1969 around the German student movement, you know, Marcuse saw the value of activism as a form of theory. Adorno would say agree as well, but he says not now, certainly not amongst the students, and not probably at any point in his lifetime. But for Marcuse, much in the kind of a civil rights notion of a Martin Luther King notion of you need to create tension to create people to think and to change things, power is not going to give up power, you know, voluntarily. You need to create tension. And for Marcuse, it's crucial that in liberal democracies that you don't simply rely on the ballot box and writing your senator, but you take the avenues that are there and available in liberal democracies, including extra parliamentary positions such as direct action, such as, you know, protest, such as, you know, occupations, in order to create tension that can help lead to change. And therefore, for him, praxis is a mode of testing what is possible in theory. It's always kind of, and you, the other thing I would have to say, you know, you need some notion of organization. You need to practice. And therefore, you need to like develop organizations so that you can't simply say, well, now's the time for change. And I'll let's, you know, Adorno kind of had this sense of like, we need to theorize. And when the moment's right, we'll know what to do. Marcuse Davis, like, no, we won't know what to do. We need to constantly practice this to see what's possible, also to help clarify our thinking about these issues.
It is interesting, given what you've just described, and Marcuse's commitment to the social movements of his time, that he actually is the one who is forgotten because Adorno, who we'll turn to in a moment, kind of tarnished his reputation in the way he put into practice how he saw theory and practice.
So in the famous letter exchange between Marcuse and Adorno in 1969 around the student movement, and particularly the occupation of the Institute for Social Research by 67, 68 students, including most of them Adorno students, in which Adorno infamously called the police on them. This was kind of the big kind of trigger in that exchange where Marcuse was like, how can you call the police? When in first out, we need to side with the students. You know, this was the big exchange. So Adorno tarnishes reputation by calling the police on the students. And in fact, he drops charges against all of them except one, his best student, Karl, where he refuses to drop the charges against. In the exchange, you see that, you know, Horkheimer had already become quite conservative in the late 50s and 60s in Germany. And there's a bit of a rah-rah USA element in Horkheimer. Somewhat understandably, he basically views the United States as saving, you know, Europe and saving Germany, and therefore there's a loyalty owed to them. But there's also a complete lack of critique that enters his work, where he has a both-sidism, particularly around the Vietnam War, that Adorno himself in this letter exchange with Marcuse picks up, saying, if you're going to protest the Vietnam War, and this is Adorno, you need to protest both sides, not only the U.S. imperialism, but also the tactics of the Viet Cong and their, you know, so-called torture and brutality. And this is where Marcuse is just like, man, you have completely forgotten to think dialectically and think in terms of power. There's a difference of violence between the oppressor continuing the oppression with violence and the oppressed trying to rise up and free themselves. So this is part of the exchange. This is where you could say Adorno tarnishes his reputation in this last exchange between Adorno and Marcuse and the other materials around it. There's quite a bit of materials that are unfortunately not yet translated into English, and hopefully someday there'll be a bigger translation of all the materials of Marcuse, Adorno, Horkheimer, and the students in the kind of mid-60s to 69, Adorno's death. But this is where, you know, Marcuse then should have gained a cachet in standing up for the students, in standing up for the right to protest. And I think he did initially in the United States and certainly also in Germany. You know, he was the bigger figure. But once Reagan, Thatcher came to power, with that shift of the kind of the first great clawback of all kind of gains that the working class had made since unionization, especially since the Second World War, Marcuse just seems to have just dropped in favor. And I think partly related to his activism.
Paul Fleming is my guest. He's the L. Sanford and Joe Mills Rees Professor of Humanities at Cornell, editor of the book series Zignala. We are discussing the Frankfurt School and the U.S. Right. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. Well, switching to Adorno, of course, the Frankfurt School went into exile in the U.S. following the rise of fascism. How did key thinkers like Adorno, again, broadly speaking, make sense of fascism? What social conditions made the terrain ripe for the rise of the far right as they saw it?
Adorno's work on fascism, on anti-democratic movements, on anti-Semitic movements, on authoritarian movements, I think is incredibly rich and unfortunately very apt and should be read today. Adorno thinks of it almost exclusively in psychological terms, but, and this is a crucial caveat, with a socioeconomic foundation behind it. And we'll get to the psychological terms in a second, but the socioeconomic foundation behind it is what he calls ego weakness. Ego weakness in the age of rampant individualism, basically capitalist modernity, in which you have an economically weakened subject that nonetheless is told, you need to provide for the family, you are self-reliant, it is your job to get a job and pay for your way in this life, you are responsible. And so this precarity, the psychological precarity of the subject based on economic conditions, this is something that is imminently exploitable. And it's imminently exploitable because we're also subjects that are basically mass marketed and mass trained from the very beginning to be consumers. And this weak ego needs compensation. And if you're not going to give them economic compensations, well, they'll look for other compensations to prop them up. And these are the psychological mechanisms that are largely based upon you need the enemy. You need to create the inside and the outside, and you need the leader figure.
Adorno wrote an essay in 1946, which I believe was written in English, called Anti-Semitism and Fascist Propaganda. And in it, he focused not on the content of reactionary propaganda, which I think is a lot of when people on the left look at propaganda, they're taking apart what is being argued. Instead, he focused on the kind of psychological effects that propaganda evokes within people. Can you explain what he argued and how he broadly understood it?
Again, it is a 1946 essay, and it was written in English, and I highly recommend this to anybody because it's a very clear, legible, jargon-free, short breakdown of the way kind of fascist propaganda, authoritarian propaganda works. And the crucial thing, again, it's on a psychological level. In other words, it is not about ideas. It is not about arguments. It's not about programs. It's not about policy. In other words, there's very little politics actually there. The arguments, if you want to call them arguments, are all aimed at the non-rational. It may be too much to call them irrational, at the non-rational side of things. Therefore, I mean, this is kind of the crucial takeaway from it. The rebuttal to fascist propaganda, authoritarian propaganda, is not to point out the logical mistake or the lies. It's not operating on that level. It's not like enlightenment where then people will be like, oh, that's a lie. Oh, now I won't follow that. It's not working that way. In other words, the lies and the logical mistakes, they're the very point. That's the way it works. And therefore, the addresses to the unconscious elements, that's what they appeal to. And the premise, again, is an ego weakness. There's something there to be exploited. And you can exploit people who are trying to stabilize their own place in the world, their own place in society, and they need to find a way to do this. And again, this would be from economic parity as far as this is the fallout of that first grade clawback in which the working class has been howled out and is rendered precarious, and they need some compensation. This also relates to the so-called crisis of young men in America. There's a desire to stabilize, and this helps explain the appeal of someone like Nick Fuentes for young males in the United States.
Yeah, so let's talk more about that argument, the argument that Adorno made, that not only is a rational explanation not going to do it, but actually part of the effectiveness is the irrational, the kind of illogical, the emotional. How do you take those insights from then and apply it to how Trump is effective? Because one can certainly see strong elements of what Adorno was describing today.
I'll leave out the leader side and kind of the psychoanalytic side that he gives in a later essay from the 1951 and just focus on what he calls the devices. I mean, one of the things I want to point out about Adorno when it comes to fascists and fascist propaganda, almost all his source material is not coming from Europe, it's coming from the United States. This is all based on U.S. radio at the time. This is Father Coughlin. And it's a series of what he calls devices or mechanisms. Now, the first great device or mechanism that helps kind of explain the Trumpian thing is it's all personalized. It's all ad hominem. In other words, there's an obsessive talking about yourself, most of all, and about the audience. And some of that obsessive talking about the self is the, you know, is the lone wolf. I'm the only one who can fix this. It is the appeal to the audience as the healthy, strong American, as the good Christian America, as the real America, as the hardworking America that also has then connotations for those who supposedly aren't that. In other words, it's all personal all the time. There is no policy there. Another device is the means for the ends. In other words, it's all about the movement. There is no policy behind it. It's just the movement itself that you celebrate. It's great to be part of this great movement. No agenda. And therefore, it's the word that Adorno analyzes, the notion of revival, that, you know, there'll be repeat revival 10 times within three sentences. This is the make America great again. You know, what's the goal of make America great again? Make America great again. How do you do it? You just make America great again. Just say that over and over. Repetition is a crucial feature of this. The other device, of course, is straw people. You need the enemy, the image of the enemy. And there's no real concern as to whether that image lines up with reality or not. But another device is innuendo, that you know what I mean. You know who I'm talking about. You don't need to say it. And that's what builds the inside and the outside group. Just to be on the in, I know what he's talking about. I belong to the in group is a big part of it. And then a crucial feature is what he calls, Adorno calls, the device of organized flight of ideas. In other words, and this is quite brilliant, there's no thinking to be done. In other words, this is what Trump calls the weave. The weave is basically, it's just a free association of ideas. It's easy for the listener to follow because there's no thinking to be done. And you just give yourself up to the stream of words. It's a very oral code. So the other thing with fascist propaganda, it's very oral. And you give yourself up to the stream of words. And that's why you can go from immigrants to Shark Week to wind farms to battleships to ballrooms to crypto. It doesn't matter. It's just the weave. And therefore, it's like, you don't need to think. You're there for the show. What the fascist leader is, the leader figure is trying to achieve is mental concord, a mental alignment, a rapport with the audience.
Adorno also writes about that it's really more the performance that pulls you in and this rapport that you say that is developed between the leader and the audience and the way that that is set up. And one of the things Adorno writes about is the importance of kind of limitlessness and dynamism. And I wonder if you could talk more about that, this idea that if you had a 5-point program, then that would be kind of delimited. But by not really spelling it all out and having this kind of free-floating presentation kind of makes, I don't know what, the agenda kind of striving forward, all-encompassing with never an end?
I mean, I want to pick up on the notion of the endless, you know, and that there's no telos there. But I want to back up about what I think is one of Adorno's really kind of really smart insights that helps explain what's going on. And, it certainly hindered a huge part of the so-called resistance and even media during the first Trump term. And that's the notion what he calls gratification. In other words, people go to a Trump rally, and you had people going to Trump rallies like they were going to dead shows. People go to the Trump rally for the show. It's all about the performance. It's sports or theater. These are the analogies that he uses. In other words, you go in order to be entertained. So the crucial way then the entertainment works is the weave. It's just that kind of flow of ideas, that kind of free association without needing to think. The other crucial dynamic in that is to have no inhibitions. I mean, one of the things that sets the leader figure apart from the rest is the leader who's the first one who's able to say what the others can't or think they cannot say. This is the great breakthrough for the leader figure in these authoritarian movements. The genius, it's called genius of the fascist agitators, they have no filter. And then even though this will often backfire, at certain moments of history, this having no filter breaks through. And finally, you have someone willing to violate the taboo and to risk making a fool of themselves, but finally say like, ah, I've always wanted to say that. They say that. And so part of this then mechanism then, as I mentioned earlier, it's not about lies or fakes or being ingenuine. You know, what Adorno says is that Hitler was loved not despite, but because of the fakery, because he was ingenuine. In other words, people want the clown show. The clown show is not the problem. That's why people show up. They expect that. That's the kind of the pleasure principle in it. And so this is not, the sentimentality is not primitive, but there's something advanced here because it's a cultivated fiction of real feeling, as Adorno would say. And all this then ties to kind of the crucial element around this is the notion of ritual or ceremony. In other words, for Adorno, you know, when they're at these rallies or on the radio, what the crowd wants is they want their feelings expressed back to them. This is the ritual. You know, he can say what we always wanted to say and that, you know, all these nasty things that I never dared to say. And therefore, this is what the crowd wants to hear. And then they can repeat it. There's this collective regression to the kind of the lowest common denominator, but this is where the chants like lock her up and keep them out come in. This is part of the ritual. And the ritual, of course, demands ultimately a sacrifice. There's kind of a pseudo-religious Christian element here is that we need a sacrifice. And the sacrifice then is, of course, you know, whether it be the immigrant, the Jew, the black, whatever it is, you need the sacrificial figure that you're constantly purging from, that's polluting society, polluting America.
So, Paul Fleming, if the far right leader's appeal is mainly performance with all of these rituals and layers that pull the audience in, how ultimately then is the support substantial? Can we draw anything from the Frankfurt School in thinking about what could erode it?
That's an excellent question. And this is where Adorno is actually quite interesting and surprising. I mean, again, so the real difficulty is that enlightenment's not the answer. You know, in other words, kind of bringing people to reason is not the answer. And part of the reason is to back up to another essay from Adorno in 1950 called Opinion, Delusion, Society, in which he gets at the kind of the problem of, or the real kind of enigma, why do people, you know, cling to their opinions as if they're clinging to their lives, when actually the thing that should be most mobile, the thing that should be easiest to give up is opinion. It's just an opinion. You know, it's just an opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll change my mind. But that's not what happens. And Adorno's trying to get at the root of that. And this goes back to the weak ego, as he says. With the weak ego, we all have a healthy dose of narcissism. In other words, we need some libidinal energy that comes from our id that is then cathected onto our ego as a way of propping up the ego and feeling good about ourselves and staying in this world. Well, with a weakened ego, what happens is that we need to cathect onto something, and therefore we cathect onto our opinions. In other words, we fall in love with our opinions. And by falling in love with our opinions, that's why we're like, we're not going to give them up, because if you attack my opinion, you're attacking me. And attacking me, I need to double down to protect myself. And that's why opinions are so hard to change. This is also the structure then of the way kind of the in-group, out-group in the kind of the fascist or authoritarian dynamic works. What this means then, as far as how you change this, is that it's not about changing people's minds. You actually need to get to a couple things. One would be getting at the ego weakness. One of the things that Adorno doesn't bring up as much as I wish he would is just like kind of the economic basis of this, and that the rise of authoritarianism is tied to a crisis of capital. I think that's what we're seeing right now. This is why it's sweeping the Western world. In other words, neoliberalism did not work out for the working class, and that's why it's the U.S., France, Germany, England, Italy, Chile. You see it throughout the world. And so to a certain extent, you would need that. But what Adorno goes for is a couple other things. What he first goes for, and these are odd, the first one's less odd, is that he says authoritarian movements, and this he shares with his friend Walter Benjamin, are ultimately grounded in destruction. They're about violence, and they're about annihilation. They're about eradication. This initially is kind of whatever the outgroup is, whether it be the Jew or the immigrant or the black or whatever it may be. But ultimately, it kind of, you know, so the way the movement, you ask, you kind of the endlessness of the movement is you need another victim. So it'll move from universities to immigrants to whatever. You can just keep moving the target. And Adorno says the one way you could actually get at them psychologically is point out the destructive and ultimately self-destructive implications of this. That there's an unconscious desire for self-annihilation. There's a certain nihilistic element to this. And to try to point that out to people, that this will ultimately the movement will transform the own followers into victims. How successful that would be, I'm not so sure, but that's one of the things, is to emphasize the destructive, violent nature of it. The second one is from the 1951 essay, which is quite interesting, where he says, you know, ultimately, and this is the when Adorno's back in Germany. I think that context matters. He's back in Germany, and he's basically, you know, anywhere he goes, he could be bumping into somebody who was, you know, SS or SA and will never know. And therefore, it's kind of constantly on his guard as to, like, the remnants of fascism still in society. And there he argues that, you know, at the very end, he says, that whole element of performance in the show, that is what defines the entire fascistic movement. In other words, for him, it's not really that deep of a thing. That the follower actually doesn't really believe the leader, nor do they really believe that story about the scapegoat, whether it be the Jew or the immigrant. In other words, Adorno believes that there's a certain instability to the entire show. And the way you read or can see this instability is the degree of kind of self-protectiveness and violence when it's criticized. You know, that reaction of wanting to protect the movement, protect it from criticism, is a sign of its kind of instability or its weakness. And the other point he says is it can dissolve really quickly because it hasn't fully regressed to barbarism. The degree of enlightenment which a society has attained doesn't entirely disappear with fascistic movements. So this is less a way of combat it, but more a way of like, what do you do in the wake of a fascistic movement as far as kind of realigning it with democracy and kind of left liberal agenda?
I wanted to ask you how this connects to the fraying of the MAGA coalition. Now, of course, some of it is to do with personal infighting about who gets to lead. But another part, of course, is around the Epstein files and Jeffrey Epstein and Trump's involvement with him. Obviously, Epstein was a real person who abused young girls on a very wide scale and coordinated the abuse, the sexual abuse of these girls by powerful men, both Democrats and Republicans. But for MAGA, it also feeds into a conspiratorial worldview around Democrats preying on children, you know, related to earlier, of course, theories about Democrats harvesting the blood of young children. And so I wanted to ask you if it's a surprise to you that this is where much of the MAGA coalition is fraying around these questions that are very emotional, very emotionally charged. And of course, in this case, the leader, Trump, is disappointing in what he's able to deliver and, in fact, you know, his own apparent deep involvement.
You know, as far as what, you know, will be pulling apart the MAGA right, I mean, one will be, I mean, again, this is back to like kind of the lacuna in Adorno's thought, the economy. You know, it's just, you know, they have not delivered at all when it comes to an economic populism. On the contrary, and people just experience that. And that experience is somewhat irrefutable. You can make all the harangues that Biden and Trump make about how good the economy is. If people don't experience it, that experience is going to be the thing that guides them. But going to the Epstein files, I mean, the Epstein files is a really interesting case study because these are things that Adorno does talk about. It's kind of these lurid tales of sexual deviancy that go back to like the blood libel of Jews and stuff like that. So there's a long tradition to this. And this is a mythology that helps explain the MAGA universe. If you're going to cling to some notion of the lurid sexual tales and these kind of evil corrupting forces, again, of which there is some truth in the Epstein files, you know, there is a real grain of important truth there, but you want to subscribe it to one party and one people, that's the outsiders. And then you need to realize this is not a Democrat-Republican, you know, thing, but a question of masculinity, patriarchy, and capitalism that cuts across those things. You get back to a class issue. And then it gets hard for a person like Trump to actually back that up. Because at the end of the day, he's not an economic populist. He speaks the speak. It got him into power. But he's done nothing in his entire time to actually deliver on this. And then it starts to blow up on you. Because the true believers, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, are going to say, Wait a minute, this was the promise, and you're not delivering on the promise. That's going to start to build in tension.
Paul Fleming, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Sasha. It was great talking to you.
Paul Fleming is professor of comparative literature and German studies at Cornell. He co-edits the journal New German Critique. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. Please tune in again next time.